الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وبعد. طيب, what were we doing last time? سعد. What are we doing nowadays? For those who weren't here last time. We were? They're just discussing the Hanafi Madhab.
If you say that they have only that belief for leaving their hands, for not raising their hands, because there's one somebody reported, one Sahabi did not raise it.
Abdullah bin Masud.
This is to me, this is
well, you, I mean, is it what?
Real refugee.
Now, I was just quoting a Tahawi in this case, that's the deal. And you have to keep in mind, by the way, with respect to the Iraqi madhab or the Kufan madhab or the Hanafi madhab, that the Hanafi madhab grew up in Iraq, and Iraq was not as proficient in hadith at that time as the rest of the Muslim world. And there were many fabricators of hadith, different groups of bid'ah coming from Iraq. So that's why the Hanafi madhab, among all the different madhab, it is the strictest. In other words, they lay down the most conditions when it comes down to accepting ahad hadith. And that's why, as I said last time, some people say that there, how many did we say? 13? Hey, 13 conditions that they lay down. And we discussed some of them. Did we? Did we get to any of them in detail?
Yeah, we discussed number 8.
Number 8. What about number 9? What about number 9, Zach? We discussed number 8 last time. But we discussed the condition that they had, that if the narrator, of the hadith, acts in a contrary manner to the hadith, or gives the fatwa contrary to the hadith, then that is a sign that the hadith is no longer to be applied. Okay, that was the general case. And then number 9, we said, is the specific case. Where if there's a hadith, which is not applied by the leading ulama of the time, for example, of the Sahaba. If Abu Bakr or Umar and people of this nature, if they do not apply a hadith, and the hadith taban is ahad, their argument is that we cannot assume, or let's put it another way, it would be better for us to assume that Abu Bakr or Umar knew the hadith and didn't apply it because they knew it wasn't to be applied, than to assume that Abu Bakr or Umar did not know the hadith.
Number 9,
yeah.
Does it mean, I thought it should be the contrary, there are the people who don't know much about hadith, they are not
Abu Bakr Umar?
The Ahnaf, and they lay down many shuruq for the hadith, shouldn't be the opposite? Because they don't know about hadith,
see, the more you know about hadith, the more you realize that its transmission is trustworthy. The less you know about hadith, the al-Athariyin, the less you trust the hadith. Well, in their case, there were reasons to doubt hadith in Iraq, because as I said, the forgers, Ahl al-Bid'ah, were there fabricating hadith. So they had reason to doubt hadith, and then secondly, they were not that strong in hadith as some other areas. And that's, of course, a general statement. Some of them, of course, were great scholars in hadith. So the 9th condition that we mentioned last time is that if there is, if one of the leading scholars of hadith, if one of the leading scholars or one of the leading sahaba doesn't apply a hadith, then that's evidence that that hadith is not to be applied. So for example, there's a hadith from the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam concerning the person who is not married who commits fornication or zina. What's the punishment for the one who commits zina, who's not married? Jild. And what else? No. How do you say that in English? And the hadith states that for the one who's not married, 100 lashes, jild. And تغريب, being expelled from the area for 1 year. Okay. The Hanafis do not apply this hadith. The reason they don't apply this hadith is because of this. They said the as far as they know, the leading Sahaba never did both. Okay. And the most, therefore, that one can say is that it is a type of that the banishment for 1 year is a type of ta'zir or optional punishment from the imam. And they even tried to bring some evidence from Umar that he expelled someone from the land, and that person ended up becoming Christian and joining the kuffar. So he swore by Allah that he would never banish anyone again. But the reason he banished that person was anyone know? It wasn't the case of zina. It was the case of the person was drinking a lot. So that's why he banished him. So when Umar said that he will not banish anyone, he might have been talking about he'll not banish anyone as a type of ta'zir. But when it comes to the hudud from the Prophet ﷺ, that is a different case. In any case, what's the response to this way of reasoning? And is it a good assumption to say that, for example, if Abu Bakr or Umar do not apply hadith, then that must be the case number one, that they knew the hadith, then it must be the case number two, that they knew the hadith is not to be applied. Is that strong reasoning? Why?
They missed
the
hadith. They were reminded by many
other Sahabi. So the actual fact during the time of Abu Bakr or Umar goes against this kind of argument. And there are many, or let's say numerous examples of where Abu Bakr or Umar did not know specific hadith, and therefore the fact that they don't apply specific hadith does not mean, yani you cannot use this as an argument that the hadith has been abrogated. And as we talked about last time, yani abrogation is one of the last things that the fuqaha resort to. You should have some yani stronger evidence than just the fact that someone didn't apply a specific hadith. So that's yani one of their conditions, number 9. And I guess we refuted it. And it is not a strong condition. But again, you have to keep in mind any of the situation that they were living in at that time. It's probably excusable for the early Kufans to believe in this kind of idea or these kind of conditions where I had, but not for the later Hanafis. Also, what was another condition is concerning
about their quote-unquote fool.
Banished.
And that guy killed.
Expelled also, yeah.
And that guy, and he became a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a proven case?
Sahih.
And happened.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure really. I just read it in their book, so I'm not really sure.
But to me, they cannot even use this.
What
if somebody, if he didn't say Kafar Ibn Salam's hand of the thief? He was so mad that he went to Kufar and became Kafar.
Yeah.
So there is that argument. To me, well, this argument doesn't make sense.
No, their argument in that case was that in the hadith of the Prophet ﷺ, the 100 lashes and taghrib for 1 year, they're saying that the taghrib is a type of ta'zir, it's not the hudud. And they're giving the example of Umar, yani that he used the ta'zir also, And he did not use it as hudud. But again, it's true, if that story is true from Umar, it is true that he used this ta'zir in that case, because he did it in the case of someone drinking.
But it could be used as ta'zir for others, but it is a rule in this case. It might be an order for zina,
yeah.
A had for zina.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, that in that case it was ta'zir, but not in the case of zina.
It has to be in all cases.
Plus, Umar, he banished other people. He banished one guy because he was too beautiful. He was fitna for the Nisa of Medina. So, to take this one incident.
Wasn't he careful of himself?
Yeah.
If he was careful of this guy, he may not be careful enough to take care of himself.
Well, that
there should be a reason for this banishment.
Yeah, he was. His presence was causing trouble.
Yeah, but maybe he's not careful enough when he's present.
Well, I imagine it seems he was innocent. Yeah, he wasn't doing anything.
Seems.
Also, another one of the conditions we mentioned last time is the hadith or any ahad report concerning the things that afflict everybody or umum al balwa, which also. And according to most of the later Hanafis, and according even to Imam al-Haramain al-Juwayni, and even Abu Hanifa himself, that if there's a ahad report concerning any these types of matters that afflict everybody, then those reports are not to be acted upon. They are not acceptable. And their proof for that is that, and these are things that occur often. So therefore the Prophet ﷺ should have explained it on more than one occasion, or at least he should have explained it to many people, such that the case, or such that it should have been the case, that it should have been transmitted by many people. In other words, it should have been mashur or mutawatir. Yeah, this is just, what number was that condition last time? Seven? So we're discussing condition number seven now. So if something of that nature is only transmitted by one or two people, according to them, that is evidence that the person, either he's not truthful in his narration or he's mistaken or something of that nature. Now, one thing about the Hanafis on this point is they are not consistent, because they make many actions obligatory, which would fall under this category, but are also reported by Ahad Hadith or through Ahad Hadith. For example, according to the Hanafis, you should make wudu from vomiting. If you vomit, you have to make wudu. Or if you laugh during the salat, you have to make wudu. Now, vomiting in particular, maybe laughing during the salat doesn't occur that much, but vomiting. Yani, I think during the time of the Prophet ﷺ, many people vomited. Yani, their argument is that if these things were not made clear by the Prophet ﷺ to many people, then many people, their acts of worship would not be valid, because they didn't receive this information. So vomiting, as I said, is something common, and therefore it has to fall under this category of the things that afflict everyone. But their only proof for it are some reports which are ahad. Not only that, some of them are weak even. So unfortunately, the Hanafis are not consistent in applying this this principle. Also, the evidence that we gave for Hujjat al-Ahad reports, they did not distinguish between things that are of this nature that afflict everyone or things that did not afflict everyone. In other words, they were general proofs that you have to follow Ahad reports, regardless of whether they fall under this category or not. Plus, there's ijma of the Sahaba, you could say, that even hadith related to these things that afflict everyone, they have to be accepted and acted upon. And we can bring many examples from the time of the Sahaba. For example, during the time of the Sahaba, there was a debate and some difference of opinion about if the man and woman have to make ghusl, and if their private parts come into contact with each other, even if they did not have complete sexual intercourse. So some of them said you have to make ghusl from that, others said you do not. So they went to Aisha, and Aisha told them the hadith from the Prophet ﷺ concerning that. And so therefore, yani, they all agreed upon that. They accepted the report from Aisha. Obviously, yani, this is something that would concern yani, every married, not single, but married Muslim. So therefore, it would come under this category. And it's one of the many examples from the time of the Sahaba that they followed hadith even into this category. No. What do you mean agreement? No, their condition is that the Sahaba, yani if you apply their reasoning, the Sahaba should not have accepted Aisha's statement, because this is something that concerns everyone and they got it just from one person. They're saying that something like this should have been known to Aisha and hundreds of others, or many others. That's their argument. So this action of the Sahaba is a proof against them. Yani that the Sahaba, in cases, even in things that afflicted yani everyone, if just one person narrated something from the Prophet ﷺ, they would accept it and follow it.
So there's a few things that you could do.
Yeah.
How about if you are fasting, get up that you will be
Muslim.
Mm-hmm. Same as Aisha.
Yeah, Abu Hurairah was giving fatwa that you do not fast that day. So they went to the wives of the Prophet ﷺ and they said that we used to do so with the Prophet ﷺ and we would fast. So Abu Hurairah changed his fatwa.
So can you use this one?
Probably, yeah.
But this is the wives. How could the Abu Hurairah this way? He was married,
right? Oh, later in his life he was married, yeah.
This then, this condition seems that it
makes sense.
Not to accept the hadith.
But yani the fact of the matter is that most of the Sharia yani affects everyone. Yani most of the Sharia. So that means the Prophet ﷺ, it would have been obligatory on him yani to explain the same things over and over and over again yani to every different people he met. And that's the way they are approaching it. That if it's something yani that concerns everyone, the Prophet ﷺ should have explained it to the extent that many of the people should have known it and should have passed it on. Yani if you think about it that way, that almost all the Sharia can, yani Umm al-Balwa is a very wide category. he thought the graduation party was today. So. But some example, actually, if you look at the examples given in the books of fiqh or in the books of usul al-fiqh, it seems that the Hanafis, and I haven't been able to confirm this yet because, as I said, I didn't have much time to prepare this lecture, but from the examples given in the books of Usul al-Fiqh, it seems that the Hanafis mostly are using this principle or this concept as a way of deciding and between conflicting reports. And they're using the principle that yani, the original case is freedom of obligation. Yani, the original case, unless there's some proof that you have to do something, then you don't have to do something. They are combining both of these principles. For example, there's a hadith, yani, or Imam Shafi wa Ahmed wa Imam Malik, they say that if a person, if a man touches his penis, then he has to make wudu. And this is based on the hadith of Busra, who narrated the Prophet ﷺ said, if anyone touches his penis, then he cannot pray until he makes wudu. Another narration states that wudu is to be made from touching the penis. The Hanafis say, yani, this is not the case. And for the Hanafis, this action does not invalidate the ablution. And their argument basically is based on two things. One is a narration from one of the Sahaba who asked the Prophet ﷺ if this action negates the ablution. And he said, no, this part is only, or the penis is only a part of you. So the Hanafis used this narration and this principle to reject the other ahad hadith. Okay, because they're saying that this is something that should have been known by everyone. That you have to make wudu from this thing. So since it's only narrated from one sahabi, maybe two at the most, then they're arguing that this is Umm al-Balwa, should have been narrated by more. And plus we have this hadith on our side. So they're using both, the other narration and also the principle. The principle that if an ahad report is concerning Umm al-Balwa, this is not acceptable.
How could it be the case that that Sahabi asked the Rasulullah?
How could it be the case?
Yeah, it should have been known.
Well, it should have been known to him, but they had to find out on some occasion. And what they mean, what they mean by Umm al-Balwa or this kind of thing, doesn't mean that everyone knows it, but many people should have known it. You have to distinguish between the two. They're not saying that everyone should have known this point, but they're saying that this point is common enough and important enough that many people should have known it. So if just one or two narrated, then this throws some doubt upon the narration.
Both reports are sahih.
Yeah.
What did they say about
the other hadith? The other hadith is not as strong as the hadith of Busra bint Safwan. And so I think they make tajih for this hadith. Plus, also in principles of usul al-fiqh, originally, obviously, it wasn't obligatory to make wudu from it. And the original case is there's no obligation. So if you find two hadith, one stating no obligation and the other one stating obligation, then the latter takes precedence over the former.
If you know
which is later, then that's no problem. But if you don't know which one is later, then obviously originally you didn't have to make wudu from this act, because originally there was no wudu before in early Islam. So if there's something obligating a deed, like in this case, it takes precedence over something that states that the deed isn't obligatory in the cases where you don't know which one came first.
Nobody said anything about shahwa.
In this case, no. Just the Shafis, they say it has to be from the touching with the inside of the hand, right? Now, in other words, if you bump against it with this side of your hand, they say this doesn't. I'm not sure what's their proof for that. I don't remember their proof. Do you? But another example, actually we talked about this one last time, but it also comes into this case, is the raising the hands for rukur and coming up, and if we're going into rukur and coming up from rukur. Okay, Imam Shafi, Ahmed, and Malik, they said, this is to be done. Abu Hanifa says no. That this is not to be done. And again, he's using this principle and a narration, because one time Ibn Mas'ud said that I will pray for you the prayer of the Prophet. Ibn Mas'ud said, I'm going to pray for you in the manner that the Prophet ﷺ prayed. Or actually, he didn't say. He said the prayer of the Prophet. And yani, when he did that, he only raised his hands at the beginning of the prayer and he did not repeat it. So this point, this narration, and this principle of if it's Ahad and it's related to Umum al-Balwa, it's not acceptable. Abu Hanifa uses these two principles to refute the hadith of Ibn Umar that says that the Prophet ﷺ used to do it. Okay. So again, yani, almost all of the examples that I came across in the books of Usul al-Fiqh, it seems yani, that this principle is one that they use to weigh yani, whether or not one report is to be followed or another one.
Last time you said it's not from Abu Hanifa.
Refuting what?
Refuting the hadith of
I said that.
No,
I didn't say. No, I said some of the principles are not confirmed from Abu Hanifa. Some of the principles. Hey, I mentioned. No, I was just showing. No, I was just showing the reasoning of At-Tahawi because he stated it explicitly. That's why I took his quote, because he stated explicitly that the reason Ibn Umar stopped doing it, or he said the only reason he could have stopped doing it or not apply the narration is because he knew that it has been abrogated. But no, this the opinion not to raise your hands while going for ruku and coming up from ruku, this is from Abu Hanifa. Yeah. Any questions about that condition? Is that condition number 7? Okay. Now we come to, I think I mentioned this condition. This is if the Ahad Hadith contradicts Qiyas or analogy. No?
In the 13th
condition. Hey, did I mention this one?
No.
Oh, just I put the number 13, I said. Wait. Now always when we talked about before, when we said the four sources of the Sharia, your notes? Of course I have your notes. I wouldn't come here without bringing your notes to class.
That's number 10 that you're going to... This is the smart debate. The only thing
Yeah, no, the one I didn't write isn't this. Okay, here's another condition then. Number 14 then. There we are. Number 14. Yeah. For those of you keeping track. No? Now, remember before we always talked about what's the source of the Sharia, we always said Quran and Sunnah. Now we're putting them together after that. What came next? Ijma'ah. And what else? Okay. And I said basically this is the Shafi'i way of looking at things. Now the question is, Ahad reports, where do they fall in? Now you would think that they are part of the Sunnah, so they should come here. Any disagreement about that? But Ahad reports for some scholars are not as definitive, for example, as Ijma'ah. And they aren't even as strong for some as Qiyas. So some of them would put them down here. So when we say Sunnah up here, they're talking about Mutawatir. Does that sound right? If you're Maliki or Hanafi, it sounds okay. Of course, Maliki, they have another one. Here, Sunnah would include Amal Ahmad, Ahl al-Medina. Ahl al-Medina. And Ijma' also would include Ijma' of Ahl al-Medina. For, yeah, as we said last time, that he looks at the Amal of Ahl Medina as a big mutawatir hadith. Yeah, well, he also, see, he has something called Amal Ahl Medina and Ijma' Ahl Medina. Ijma' of Ahl Medina would be something based on ijtihad. And then it would come to this level. While the Amal Ahl Medina, which comes to this level, is based on naql, something coming from the Prophet. Okay. Abu Hussein al-Basri, he says, and he divides under this condition, he divides Qiyas and Khabar Ahad into different categories. Number one, okay, by the way, Qiyas, obviously we're not going to get to that this semester. Qiyas has basically four parts to it. Okay. And one of the parts known as illa. What does illa meaning here? Not defect. Okay, the cause. I know there's in logic there's a better definition or better translation than cause, but that's what they mean. The cause for the ruling or the reasoning behind the ruling. Okay. Yeah, hikmah, it's sometimes called hikmah by later scholars. But there's a difference between hikmah and illa. Pardon me? Yeah, there's four basic aspects to illa. One is the cause of the, or the reason for the ruling. Okay? Reason for the ruling. So, Hassan al-Basri, the Mu'tazili and Al-Mu'tamid, he said that if the illah or the cause is stated in the text, and if we look, okay, stated in the text, in other words, the illah is actually stated in the Quran or in the Hadith of the Prophet, says it. Okay, and that text is qati, and it's yani dilala. In other words, it's not open to interpretation. Okay, and the Ahad report contradicts the fulfillment of the qiyas. Then qiyas takes precedence. By agreement, he says. For example, what's the illa for khamr being haram? Yeah, what's the illa? Hmm? No? But yani it is more explicitly stated in a hadith of the Prophet. Yeah, anyway, it's the same thing. Make someone drunk. Okay? So the text is qati. You cannot interpret the text in any other way. And the illa is stated in the text. So if, for example, this is a hypothetical example. If, for example, there was a type of drink that makes you intoxicated, and there was an ahad report saying that this drink is halal. Okay. Now from qiyas, from this text, all such drinks should be haram. So if the ahad report makes that drink to be halal, then according to Al-Basri, يعني in this case the qiyas takes precedence over the report. No. But he did say by agreement here, I like this. He didn't say ijma', he didn't say ijma', but ittifaq. No, it's a little bit less than ijma'. So the second case, okay, if the nasr or the text is dhanni, and it's dilala, okay, and the ahad contradicts it, what I meant to say, I'm sorry, the illa again, the illa is stated in the text, the illa is stated in the text, but the text is a dhanni. In other words, it is open to interpretation, not like this case over here. And the Ahad report contradicts it. In this case, what takes precedence? Obviously, yes. Ahad takes precedence by agreement. Because it is a direct statement, direct and clear statement on the question. And he says here, this is by agreement again. Not sure who he's referring to exactly. Okay, so if the text is dhanni, that is sufficient to raise the ahad above the qiyas that is being made on the basis of that text. Is it clear, Doctor? Third case is what? Dhanni fi dalala. No, dalala. And it's open to interpretation, as opposed to this one, which yani is not open to interpretation. This is definitely the illa, no question about it. But here, yani, it is the illa is stated, but yani it is yani the difference between qat'i wa dhanni fi dalala. It is not that clear. Yes, yes. This is against who? Well, we haven't gotten to the Hanafis yet. Yeah. Okay, the third one is the illa is derived from the text. Or it is derived in general, I guess I don't have to say from the text. What do we mean by that? Okay. The illa is not explicitly stated in the text, but the scholar sits down and thinks and tries to find, and based on all the evidence, what is the illa for that? Okay, so if the illa is derived from the text, then what? Then the ahad definitely comes first. Pardon me? Yeah, definitely. That's why I said definitely, then the ahad comes first, by agreement. The difference between the two is that here the illa is stated in the text. It is stated. But the way of the reasoning, or the way of the ruling of the text, is dhanni. It is open to interpretation. But here the illa is not stated at all. It's scholar has to come up with his own illah, and there's many ways to do that. It's an interesting topic in Usul al-Fiqh, just to get you encouraged for next year. Next year the course will be held in Madison, Wisconsin, right? Follows the principle. But yeah, I'm sure there'll be some courses on Usul al-Fiqh in Jeddah. Yeah? 2 days a week, or 2 days a semester? Oh. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me, I'm so sorry. I left out something here, by the way. This is Dhanni. It is derived from a text which is Dhanni. The text is open to many ways of interpretation. So first, see the problem here is first you have to figure out how to interpret the text, and then you figure out the illah after that. So there's two steps involved. Hence this one takes precedence. Yeah, it has to be done. No, the next category is illah is derived from qat'i text. Okay? And the ahad contradicts. Yeah, the text has only one meaning to it, but it's not stating an illa. See, some texts state an illa, some don't. Okay, and he says, okay, then in this case, when the ahad contradicts it, he said, this is the place where the Hanafis and the others disagree. Okay? He said, this is where the Hanafis and the others disagree. Hanafis say what? Yeah, the Hanafis say, Qiyas comes first. Bismillah. Tayyib. Now, one point about this is that there are many Hanafis themselves. Okay, there's Hanafis themselves that say that this statement or this conclusion that we made that Qiyas comes first is bid'ah in their madhab. Okay, Hanafis themselves, they say that this is yani something. Abu Hanifa never said it. Abu Yusuf never said it, and it is not their madhab. Okay, Al-Qarhi, for example, is one of them. He said, yani, this is not our madhab.
That's only in the first part,
right? Yeah. Yani, they claim that the others are clear, but that's something we should also discuss. So this is basically an opinion of the later Hanafis. Okay? For Shafi, for Imam Ahmed, and for the majority of the scholars, including Al-Qarhi, except for some of the Malikis, Ahad always comes before Qiyas. Okay? Falls under the Sunnah, it always comes before Qiyas. Okay, as I said, Al-Bukhari, Abdulaziz Al-Bukhari, one of the leading scholars of the Hanafis, he says that this is not the correct opinion of the Hanafis. Al-Qarhi also. And in fact, you can go to many statements of Abu Hanifa himself that, and in some cases he said that if it were not for the report or for the hadith, we would have judged according to Qiyas. And in other words, he's saying explicitly that if it wasn't for a hadith, some hadith that he heard, then Qiyas, they would have made Qiyas. But since there's the hadith, yani, there's no room for Qiyas. Okay. Now the Hanafis that do yani, follow this opinion that Qiyas takes precedence, some of them, they divide the narration into two categories. Okay? So there are those hadith, those ahad, narrated by someone who they consider a faqih, or a jurist. Okay. Among the Sahaba, they consider some of them fuqaha, and they consider others non-fuqaha. As I said, yani the later Hanafis, they say, for example, that Abu Huraira was not a faqih. So the reason they make this distinguishing between what is narrated by a faqih and by a non-faqih, is in order to say this. If the ahad report is narrated by a faqih, then it always takes precedence over qiyas. Later, Hanafis, yeah. Okay. If it is narrated by a faqih, then it takes precedence over qiyas. And basically the argument here is that for some reason they are assuming that most of the hadith were transmitted according to their meanings. Okay, not according to the exact words of the Prophet ﷺ. Now, if you go back to the history of the Sahaba and how they narrated hadith, this is not a good assumption. And the Sahaba were very careful, and not to add even just one simple letter to what the Prophet ﷺ was saying. So they're saying that if a non-faqih narrates it, and he's narrating according to the way he understood it, since he's not a good faqih, then the way that he understood it may not be correct. And therefore, qiyas in that case is less doubtful than how this person narrated. But if he is the faqih, then we don't have to worry about that. Obviously, he knows what he's saying. Okay. Let's look at some of their proofs. Proofs that qiyas takes precedence over ahad reports. Especially if it's narrated by a faqih. Okay. Number one, they say this is the action, or this is the way of the Sahaba. They say that this was the manner in which the Sahaba behaved. Well, their proof, for example, they say that Ibn Abbas heard that Abu Huraira was saying that you have to make wudu from whatever touches fire. Okay, that's a hadith. And Ibn Abbas said that, okay, suppose I make wudu with water which is heated. Do I have to make wudu from the wudu itself? So they're saying this is the Sahabi rejecting ahad report on the basis of qiyas. They also said that just a second. They also use the example of Umar and Fatima bint Qais concerning the maintenance of a divorced woman. Okay. The second proof is that qiyas is confirmed or established by Quran, Sunnah, and Ijma'. While there is some doubt about the authenticity or correctness of ahad reports. Okay, so therefore they're saying that since there's some doubt about whether the ahad report, the statement actually comes from the Prophet, then we should follow the thing that we know that is confirmed by the Quran, Sunnah, and Ijma. Consequently, if an Ahad report contradicts the Qiyas, it is actually contradicting something confirmed by the Quran, Sunnah, and Ijma. And if an Ahad report contradicts Qiyas, it is actually contradicting something which is confirmed by the Quran, Sunnah, and Ijma. I like that argument. No? Yes, yes. As I said, this, the Hanafis themselves, at least the, some of the some of the leading later Hanafis, they said this is not from Abu Hanifa. Okay. Number three, the narrator of an Ahad. That's an N. Narrator of an Ahad, of an Ahad report, could have been mistaken, or he could have forgotten something. Well, there's no fear of that with respect to Qiyas. And in Qiyas, you go directly to what has been confirmed, you have the Quran or Sunnah, and you make Qiyas based on it. So there's no fear of, you know, the thing that you're basing on hasn't been transmitted properly and so forth. Number four. It is possible that there is takhsis for the Ahad report but this is not possible for Qiyas. There's no such thing as making takhsis for Qiyas. So therefore the proof that has this possibility must be weaker than the proof that doesn't have this possibility. Yeah? Specification or particularization. Particularization might be better. And finally, you can definitely tell this is from the later books of Usul al-Fiqh, the way they argue in some cases. That the qiyas is based on one's own thinking and dhan, and this is to be preferred than to be based on someone else's dhan. That if you're not sure about something, it's better to follow the thing that you're not sure about completely than to follow what someone else isn't sure about completely. Huh? Yeah. So therefore, conclusion is that in this ranking over here, Qiyas comes before Ahad reports. Any comments? Do you all agree with this?
So, in the beginning, you said that in Rahna, you practice the things they matter, but they practice things.
Mm-hmm.
So how can they get up?
Yeah. Sometimes, as I said, so the better Hanafi, the better scholarly Hanafis like Abdul Aziz al-Bukhari and others, they reject this idea. But the reason they came up with this idea is that to them, there are some reports that Abu Hanifa didn't follow. And they couldn't figure out why he didn't follow them until they came up with this idea. That the Qiyas comes before.
Well, if they still, by doing this also, they are going to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So with Abu Hanifa, it's Qiyas before the Ahad, the Sahaba, the Mashur.
Well, pardon me? Oh, I see. Okay, yeah. Yeah. But one of the people who recorded these different opinions, except for number five, and refuted them, was Abdulaziz al-Bukhari, Kashf al-Asrar. Except five. Yeah, five. Yeah, he didn't mention five. Five al-Amadi mentioned in his book, Al-Ahkam. No, he's Shafi'i. Abdulaziz al-Bukhari, he's Hanafi. And that's one of the classic works of Hanafi, Kashf al-Asrar. And as I said, if you find it, buy two copies, one for me and one for you. Shar Kashf al-Asrar, Kashf al-Asrar, this Shar Usul al-Bazdwi. Maybe Sajjah, I think. But anyone have any comments about this? Class, and we're going to conclude that this is correct. What about the first one? This is the way of the Sahaba. Is that right? So what do you call dia in English? Or actually not dia. Not dia. No. And if I injure you, I should pay you something. La hukuma. This is. These are much later terms. This is not from the time of the Sahaba. No. That's not dia. No. Anyway. We all know. You all have your own word for it. We all know what we're talking about. No. For example, yani with respect to fingers, 10 camels for what? For one finger? No, it's not. It is more specific than dia. Anyway, suppose there's 3 fingers, 4 fingers. And the sunnah changes. It doesn't just go 10, 20, 30, 40. If I injure one finger, it's 10, 20, 30, 40. Had Umar ibn al-Khattab, he used to do that. Until someone told him a hadith of the Prophet ﷺ, that that's not the case. I don't remember what it is exactly off the top of my head. Just something like 10, 20, 30, 30 or something like that. And he doesn't just go like that. And he was applying qiyas. Okay. So he said, yani, if it wasn't for this report, we would have applied right. Uraya at that time is the same, pretty much as Qiyas. And you can find other examples from the time of the Sahaba, in which they used to make Qiyas for things, but then as soon as they found the report, they would leave their Qiyas. And the only time that they would leave a report, yani, is not because on the basis of Qiyas, but on the basis of other things. For example, the example they brought between Umar and Fatima bint Qais, this was not on the basis of Qiyas. But just clearly that what she was saying was contradicting the Qur'an. Not contradicting qiyas based on the Qur'an, but contradicting the wording of the Qur'an. So therefore, any their argument that it's the way of the Sahaba, this is not correct. This is not true. Okay, I did number one for you. What about number two? Number one was the easiest to refute. Actually, the others are all logical arguments. Number two, I like this. Number two... Qiyas is confirmed by the Quran, Sunnah, and Ijma'a. Therefore, if Ahad report contradicts it, and it wasn't, Umar wasn't making Qiyas on the basis of the Quran or Hadith, and therefore refuting Fatima. But he was saying that what Fatima was saying was contradicting the wording of the Quran. Not Qiyas based on the Quran, but the wording of the Quran itself. Okay, what about number two? Qiyas is confirmed by the Quran, wa Sunnah, wa Ijma'. Now, confirmed. What they mean by confirmed is that it is hujjah based on the Quran, or Sunnah, or Ijma'ah. So what's your answer to that? Exactly, and we talked about Hujjat al-Ahad, Ahad, whatever. And we brought proofs from the Quran, Sunnah, wa Ijma'ah, yani confirming the position of Ahad reports. So therefore what they're saying yani isn't completely true. Yani. Both the Quran and Ahad reports are based on or are confirmed, I mean, by the Quran, wa Sunnah, wa Ijma'ah.
Another statement, I would say, what we are trying to prove is when the Ahad is against Qiyas, mm-hmm. and the Qiyas should have been abolished by this Ahad report, had they known about it. So it's not whether Qiyas is strong.
Now their problem is that yani it's not just a matter that the Qiyas is stronger than Ahad, is that unfortunately they seem to doubt Ahad reports. See, it goes back to that thing where they have a strong doubt about Ahad reports. So they're yani doubting whether in fact this came from the Prophet Muhammad
ﷺ. Yani for them, do they have Qiyas based on Ahad?
Yeah, that's okay. I guess. Alhamdulillah. I assume that would be okay.
Something I need to write or something.
Hey.
Must be weaker.
That's another usul al-fiqh type argument.
How come they say Ahad?
Yani they're trying to, as you see from their arguments, they are really trying to force yani their madhab. What about number three? That the narrator may have forgotten or been mistaken. And when we talk about Ahad, first of all, we're talking about Ahad reports and which are acceptable. And we lay down some conditions for that, right? That the narrators have to be dhabit or proficient. It cannot be shad or ma'lul. And so we've taken care of number three. Yes. And also qiyas. If you study qiyas, yani the root, or the route. Some say route, some say route, but make it clear, I'll say route. The route from getting from the verse in the Quran to the conclusion of Qiyas sometimes is much more doubtful than someone yani making a mistake in his narration. What about number four?
Mm-hmm.
There's a big problem with number four. Qiyas al takhsis?
If you're making qiyas or something, you have to apply to this thing that you're making qiyas.
Pardon?
For this particular case. Yeah.
Pardon?
No, qiyas, you generalize. Every anything, every drink which is intoxicating is haram. By qiyas, every drink, yani you apply it to any drink. That may not be qiyas, that's actually something else, probably. But there's a real big problem with this.
But something should be happened by another hadith.
Yeah, but they're saying is maybe we don't know the other report.
Well,
now if you take this argument number four literally, then that means that Qiyas jumps up to number one on that list, because also verses in the Quran, there could be made takhsis for verses in the Quran, so therefore Qiyas should come before even the Quran. Even mutawatir hadith, there might be takhsis for it. So therefore yani you're putting Qiyas number one. Number five? No, they believe in takhsis al-am, but am is qat'i. So therefore, the thing that makes takhsis for it has to be as strong.
Quran is
Mathalan, yeah. So it doesn't, yani it doesn't mean that they don't believe in takhsis, but they, it means yani that since the am is qati, the thing that makes takhsis has to be much stronger for them. What about number five? Does number five make sense? Well, yani the problem with number five is that would my dhan or my thinking be better than someone else's thinking that, or someone else's what he thinks is reported from the Prophet, or what he thinks he heard from the Prophet? And one is narrating something from someone who is ma'soom. So it's not just me against someone else, but someone else supposedly narrating something from the Prophet. Yeah, I'm saying, but which then, and it could be from the Prophet, that then, or that suspicion might be as strong as the suspicion that what I'm thinking is right. I would prefer, this is why Imam Ahmad said that a hadith which is da'if is more beloved to me than qiyas, because there's a chance that this is correct from the Prophet, and that chance is stronger than my chance of being right in my qiyas. Almost, yeah. They are not giving it its true value. So, yeah. To give an example of, well, let's move on to the Malikis, and since Mustafa was the last to speak, what about Imam Malik? With respect to Imam Malik, does Qiyas come first or Ahad reports? Which comes first? Which comes first, Mustafa? No, for Imam Malik. Yeah, there's some Malikis that claim... Pardon? No, I didn't say Malik. When I went over there, I left Malik's name out of it. There's some Malikis that claim that Imam Malik put Qiyas before Ahad reports. Any comments? Sounds good. But according to Hamid Biltaji, and studying Imam Malik, and he concluded that we never find Imam Malik leaving anything from the Sunnah, yani based on general qiyas reasoning. If he left the report, it was because it either did not meet his conditions for acceptability, or it contradicted stronger sources of the Sharia. Okay, and we'll mention three of the examples that some of the later Malikis say is proof that Imam Malik put Qiyas before Ahad reports. There's a hadith from Abu Huraira concerning the when the dog licks a bowl, licks in some food. The hadith states that the food, what is in the bowl, should be thrown away, and the bowl should be washed seven times. One time, either the first or the last, depending on which riwayah you have, should be with Sa'd's major. So Imam Malik said, and Imam Malik doesn't accept this report, or at least he doesn't apply it. And he said that the hunting dog eats from the meat, can eat from the meat of the animal, or at least he puts his mouth and he digs into the animal. And so therefore, how can his saliva, the dog's saliva, be disliked? Very strong? And qiyas. Oh, so you're putting qiyas before ahad also, huh? So you're making takhsis, no one. If a dog is najis, shouldn't it be the case that all dogs are najis? And the saliva? Okay, you're getting... But the point is, here, is that is Imam Malik here actually putting Qiyas before Ahad report? Oh, what's part? Yes, yani what he's saying, now what he's saying is that this Ahad report goes against the Quran. No, in this case, yani clearly he's talking about the verse in the Quran. And if this Ahad report contradicts the Quran, which is, what would we call that? And in our, remember we gave five conditions for hadith, or yeah, that would be shad. So we would reject it. Okay? But, pardon me? And for him, but for him, yani the hadith is contradicting this verse anyway. But yani this is the Maliki madhab. It is not the madhab of the other scholars, because for them, yani they do not consider this this hadith yani to be contradicting the Quran. Because as Abu Sa'id mentioned, yani, there's no need to say that they are in conflict, because one is simply giving rukhsa, or a special license in a special case. Well, you'll find that often in the Sunnah and so forth. Yani, you could call it tahsis of one way or another. But the fasting, the 6 days in the month of Shawwal, this is a topical... What did Imam Malik say about fasting 6 days in the month of Shawwal?
I said,
you what the people do. What do the Amal al-Jazair do? Sahih? Some of them don't fast Ramadan. What do you mean? Not all. Okay, according to Imam Malik, he said he never saw any of the people of Ilm or Fiqh fasting those days, and it is not reported from any of the Salaf, and it is a type of bid'ah, and he's afraid that people will take it as something that goes with the month of Ramadan. So it is yani makruh, very strongly makruh, if not haram. Yani he's the point he's making is that yani he made the he's saying yani that people will take it as part of Ramadan, and they'll have to do it. And it seems clear that Imam Malik was not aware of the hadith about fasting the 6 months of the 6 days of Shawwal. But we can also see that, and although some of the later Malikis use this as a proof that he puts qiyas before Ahad reports, we can see that in fact he wasn't using qiyas here. He was maybe using sadad ra'i, that if they fast. That they fast 6 days, yani they were considered part of Ramadan, that is wajib like Ramadan.
Is that
the Hassan al-Mudawwana. What do you mean? He didn't mention the hadith. He just said, yani, that I don't know anybody of knowledge who does it.
Is this the hadith
in
Sahih?
It's in Sahih Muslim.
Bukhari?
Yeah. Seems. Al Mum al Zalwa.
From the Arabs of the Sahara.
Yani. Yeah, he's saying, yani, I've never seen any of the people of Ilm or Fiqh doing it. Yani, it could be the case that the people of Medina did not know this hadith. Suppose that this is something the Prophet ﷺ said yani, during the last year of his life, the last Ramadan. Yani, it's not necessarily the case that it was true for the first Ramadan, second, third, fourth, and fifth. There's no evidence for that. There's no reason for us to assume that. So suppose it was yani, during the last Ramadan, where the Prophet ﷺ told it to a group of people who were in the mosque. Right? Maybe that group was 30 or 40. Well, some of these Sahaba who heard this, they may have died during the time of Abu Bakr, and others went to other cities, such that this Sunnah or this Hadith was known in other cities. It wasn't known in Medina.
nothing wrong with that. The fact is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala preserved the sunnah, but it's not necessary for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to preserve it through the people of Medina.
But you said that I haven't seen any people from Medina.
Oh, but you know Imam Malik, who are the people of ilm al-fiqh? They are the people of Medina. Imam Malik did not travel. There's something different between him and the other scholars. Imam Malik did not leave Medina. He had no need to. The other scholars were coming to him, to Medina. So, it's not the case that he traveled to other areas and he never saw anybody do it. Sure, but that's not during Shawwal. Should be talking about it. Why should they talk about whether they fasted in Shawwal or not? There you are. Did he make Umrah in Shawwal? This is the question. Also, whoever eats out of forgetfulness during Ramadan. The hadith of Abu Huraira is that if you forget that you're fasting and you eat, هذا is something Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave you and you just continue your fast. And there's no mention of that the day should be made up. Imam Malik says that the day is to be made up. Similar to the one who forgets one of the arkan of the salat, he has to make up the salat. But the way that Imam Malik narrated this hadith, because this hadith has different narrations. Some of the narrations simply say that this was food that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave to the person and he should fast the rest of the day. Other narrations explicitly state that there's no qada for that day, that you don't have to make up that day. So Imam Malik, apparently the only versions of the hadith he knew were those that simply state that this is something Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave you, and doesn't mention the fact that qada. So without any text, without any nusus, then he makes qiyas. That like the one who's missing one of the arkan of the salat, he forgot one of the arkan of the salat, he has to make it up. Similarly, if he eats out of forgetfulness, he has to make that day up. So the conclusion of some of the scholars concerning Imam Malik is that in fact all of the proofs that some of the later Malikis tried to give for Qiyas coming before Ahad reports are not valid. That Imam Malik put Ahad before Qiyas. طيب. And finally, an important point that Ibn Taymiyyah makes in a number of his writings, in particular, he has a writing called Al-Qiyas fi Sharia or something like that. He makes the point that Qiyas is supposed to be based on what? Okay, Qiyas. And you make qiyas on the basis of the nusus. Okay. If you make qiyas on the basis of the nusus, that means that the qiyas is confined by what the nusus say. So therefore it's impossible for something in the sharia to contradict correct qiyas. Qiyas which is done properly. Because number one, the source of the qiyas is the sharia itself. So for example, the Hanafis, they say that if you hire someone for wages, first of all, just thinking in general, if I hire you, if I tell you to build me something and I'm going to pay you such and such, should that be halal or haram? According to Qiyas. According to Qiyas? Yeah, I need a fatwa. According to Hanafis, hiring for wages is something which is halal, which goes against Qiyas. Because when you hire for wages, in essence, what you're doing is you're selling something that you don't have. Well, this is not the book.
Hiring for wages.
Not renting. But yeah. Mm-hmm. Human action. And you're hiring something, you're paying for something that doesn't exist. You're making a contract for something that doesn't exist. So the Hanafis, some of the Hanafis said that it is a sale of a benefit or a yield, but this benefit is not in existence at the time of the contract. It is illegal to sell something that does not exist, and therefore this type of contract should be invalid according to analogy. Yes. So Ibn Taymiyyah, his argument, yani, is that it is clear from hadith that this thing is halal. And it is clear from hadith that this kind of action is halal. So you have to make your qiyas based on what the nusus say. The nusus say that this thing is halal. So how can you say it goes against qiyas? And if the nusus itself say it is halal. Yeah, this is Ibn Taymiyyah's point. Yeah, this is Ibn Taymiyyah's point, that anything that goes against the nusus, by definition, is improper qiyas. And he also refutes them in other ways. He says, first of all, that the purchase of something which isn't existent at the, you know, which isn't in existence, is not always invalid according to the Sharia. And that, in other words, it's, well, the problem is, as you said, it is a qiyas which is invalid because it is based on some principles which are not actually correct. Hada, his Risala and Qiyas is in Majmu' Fatawa Ibn Taymiyyah. It's very interesting reading, especially for this kind of argument where people try to put qiyas before nusus or ahad reports in particular. But there's also, I think, one of the conditions we mentioned for Abu Hanifa is that with respect to hudud, you don't accept ahad reports when it comes to hudud. What's their reasoning then? That was, I think, the one that I didn't explicitly write on the board. Yeah, very nice reasoning. You don't accept ahad reports if they're related to hudud. What's their reasoning? Quickly, we don't have much time. Huh? So it is a kind of umum al-dalwa. Yeah, that's what some of the Hanafis say. But they have another argument, a little bit more refined than that one. There's a hadith of the Prophet ﷺ that says that yani, if there's any shubha or any doubt, then you should not apply the hudud. So they're saying that ahad reports are dhanni, or that it's doubtful that it's from the Prophet ﷺ. So therefore, yani, since it cannot be completely confirmed, you should not make any hudud punishments according.
You said that there's two reports saying different.
Yeah. But number 10? There should be another one there. Okay, then make it number 15. Yeah, those, as I told you, those are the ones that Al-Khotri mentioned. Maybe Al-Khotri missed a couple. And the refutation, anyway, for that point of view, is that the hudud is established on what basis? And I'm not talking about legally, but I'm talking about, for example, in the court. Hudud is established on what basis? Huh? No, no, in the courts. Not exactly thubut al-jarima, but it is based usually on witnesses. Right? So if you want to take this argument, there's no way you can actually confirm what the witnesses are saying. So therefore there's shubha in every case. In that case there's no hudud, yani, according to them. And in conclusion, about all of these conditions, As-Sarakhsi, the Hanafi scholar, he said that the hadith is...